power on.
The following is a presentation of the Sovereign podcast feed.
Ooh, the Golden Stallion, the Man of Tomorrow, Savzu, the Rated R radio star, here with you to share something with you that it was a great honor to be a part of. I was recently, as I have been often, admittedly, I was recently on the Agora podcast for not an Into the Void, which a lot of people know us for doing, myself, Sec, and Penguin of the Agora podcast. We do our little sub-series called Into the Void, which we'll get into doing those again in the future, I'm sure. But this was something different. This was a panel akin to the food panel that myself, Mrs. Sovereign, and many other incredible panelists were on for the Agora podcast. But this one is, ironically, to do with another kind of a feeding, in this sense, perhaps of the soul, even though I'm not a fan of that word at all. And it's a completely misunderstood concept. Regardless, I was asked to be on the spirituality panel. And it was, you know, sort of about spirituality as a liberatory force. We'll certainly get started on that conversation in this, and I imagine more of these conversations are to come. But it was a fascinating panel to be on. Of course, I am there as the atheist Kabbalist, atheist in the sense that I don't believe in God, Kabbalist in the sense that, well, it's a lineage that I carry and am well knowledgeable in and practice. So, you know, you get a lot of different perspectives here. There's a Christian mystic here. There's, of course, me, the Jewish mystic or Kabbalist that's here. There is a Muslim, of course, in Penguin. And then there is whatever Sec wants to be. And also we're very graciously joined by none other than the host of the Vanu podcast, Rayo, and a great time was had by all. Like I said, this is a conversation that goes all over the place. And, you know, out of respect, trying to be a little bit professional with the panelists, I mean, there's certainly times where I wanted to break in and go, oh, no, no, no. But we'll save that perhaps for next time. Regardless, I think there's a lot to take away from this conversation, a lot of interesting perspectives to glean, and they are very differing perspectives, certainly many times far differing than my perspective on things that people know me for through Sovereign Tech's, you know, over a decade history. Regardless, I think it's something you're going to enjoy. So it's included here for you in the Sovereign feed as a bit of a bonus for everyone to take on. And of course, check out and follow all of this action on the Agora podcast feed as well. Cool stuff happening there and more to come from there. Big conversations, including one around AI that I was a part of a formal debate. Can't wait to share that with all of you. But go ahead and jump on it. I'm going to let this episode just ride itself out after you hear the dream harp go. And I will see all of you, woo, on the other side.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the Agora podcast. We're back. It's your home for localism, radical decentralization, agorism, and anti-authoritarian concepts in whatever order you want, of course. So we're back with another one of our panel discussions, first of the year, one of our first episodes of the year. I think it's our second episode of Agora for the year. How are you doing, Sec?
I don't know, man, living the dream. Busy. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood over here. Worked all morning. So I don't know. Just the usual, you know, it's springtime.
Yeah, I worked. I'm going to have to be working probably most of my Saturdays for quite a while, which is great news. I mean, you know, business is good. Everything's growing. Everything's growing really fast, actually.
Yeah, same. All right. Well, today we're doing a panel discussion on spirituality as a tool of liberation for everybody listening. I'm going to just hand it off to people and let them introduce them. If everybody, when you are calling, you just tell people who you are and maybe a little bit about your spiritual practices, if we want to start there. And, you know, does anyone have a hard stop? I was planning on going about an hour and a half. I meant to ask this before we started.
Hour and a half is good to me.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
Okay, cool. All right, Brian, we'll start with you. Go ahead.
All right.
Introduce yourself.
Sure. So I am Dr. Brian Sovereign, of course, no stranger to the Agora podcast, as we talk about all kinds of crazy things whenever I happen to show up, and I'm sure today will be very little different. But I host the podcast Sovereign Tech, and as far as my spirituality goes, I guess I could say I'm a Kabbalist. Some people, that word can mean a lot of things. A lot of times I will just say Jewish mystic. I am ethnically Jewish, as well as practicing a form that might look strange to other Jews, but I'm sure that'll come up through a lot of this. And I've been that for a good chunk of my life, even though as far as spiritual background, I mean, I had a time frame. I grew up Jewish. My parents converted to Christianity, particularly Seventh-day Adventism, and went through that for much of my teenage years. But then later on in life, well, there'd be a lot of travails throughout that, but later on in life would basically get back to more formally practicing Jewish mysticism. Though I will say, and I want to get this out of the way early, and this is where it would look a little bit different than perhaps, you know, what more rabbinic Jews would talk about. I don't believe in a sky daddy God. So, you know, a lot of people will know me from my show as being a hardcore atheist. That is ultimately, that is still true. It never changed. I never changed. I don't believe in a, you know, in this grander power God whatsoever. So that's just me. And I am intrigued to hear about the spiritual background of the other panelists.
Let's go to Awe next.
Hey, I'm Awe. I'm the host of the I Hate the Antichrist podcast, where we talk about everything that we hate of the evil within ourselves and the world, but mostly within ourselves, because that's really the only evil you can address. And that's kind of where my spirituality comes from. Is it's all about addressing your internal evils, because we're sanctified from within, not from outside. So that's the basis. So I consider myself a Christian mystic. I grew up in the Evangelical Free Church. However, I drifted away from that when I became a teen. I ended up not completely apostatizing from Christianity, but I got heavily into psychedelics and Eastern pantheistic monism, and that informed a bit of what I follow now, but only insofar as it lines with the Christian upbringing I have, because I kind of returned to that after a while. So I'm sure we'll get into that during the podcast, but basically I'm a Christian mystic. I'm a somewhere in between Protestant and Catholic Orthodox, one of the three. I'm kind of like treading the middle ground between all of them, and I'll just leave it at that for now.
Awesome, thank you, Rayo.
You're sure, up, man. Sure, right on. My name is Shane Rayo too. I'm the host of the Vane podcast, where we, I guess, a lot of our focus is on physical self-liberation, which I guess that was my focus early on. And I guess later on, I guess I now realize the importance of mental and spiritual self-liberation too. So it's kind of rather new for me, I guess you could say. I was raised a generic Christian in the Midwest. I got baptized at age 16 or 17. And then, yeah, really stopped caring about it and, started questioning it. It really didn't make sense. I guess I was definitely, for a few years, pretty atheistic. And that really didn't change too much. I really didn't give much thought to spirituality or religion, other than, obviously recognizing religion as a big tool of control. But I guess in 2019, I kind of set off on this on a journey to reverse my so-called type 1 diabetes. And I had to look into everything and leave no stone unturned. This led me to Ayurvedic medicine, which claims the route to juvenile diabetes is actually past life sins or sins of parents. Now, I don't know if that's actually the case now, but that was like that. That's one thing I stumbled across where I was like, okay, this is going to have to my health journey is going to, you know, it's going to turn into a spiritual journey pretty quickly. And then, yeah, I guess that kind of, you know, kind of ramped up a little bit in 2020. And I, you know, went deep into, I guess, a lot of what I'd call new age stuff, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, but a lot of it, you know, was at least half of it, is, yeah, not really accurate or true, at least from my perspective. And, yeah, I think there's obviously some nefarious aspects to it as well. You know, if we're talking about liberation, and I guess where it's evolved to kind of now, and I guess I would kind of I kind of like Yahweh's explanation about you know, it's more of an internal journey. The solutions are, you know, are inside, are within, and it led me to folks like Walter Russell, who was an artist who went into a 40-day channeled state and wrote a book combining spirituality and science called The Universal One. He came up with these most beautiful charts and images. And I guess I'll mention this, because it was kind of the first point where I kind of had, you know, grounding to my spirituality per se. It wasn't just, it wasn't, you know, way out there, at least, wasn't way out there, which wasn't what I was, which kind of what it evolved to. But, then I came across, this would have been, last year, I guess a year or two ago. Came across Jack Gertschiff, who was a from the, I guess, anthroposophical school, following Theosophy in the 1800s, and he you know, was keyed into a lot of, I guess, Brian's talking about Kabbalistic knowledge. I bet that was definitely one thing that he that Gertschiff investigated, along with you know, all sorts of other traditions. He went on a long personal spiritual journey himself. Educational journey, but I guess his focus is psychological. I guess that's the approach is psychological. As far as actual practices, I don't even know what I'd call myself really, but I guess that's a couple of vantage points. But I guess at the end of the day, I used to meditate a lot, which Walter Russell kind of put a scientific and like very practical use of meditation. So I really don't do that much anymore. But you know, I convene with nature. Convene with creation, and that's kind of my spirituality, I guess you could say. I guess that's a good enough introduction for now.
Right on. You know, it just occurred to me that we're setting up like that joke where it's like so and so walks into a bar. It's like we got the Christian mystic, the atheist Jew, a Muslim, and something else, and an atheist walk into a bar. This is this panel right now. Penguin, you're up, man. What do you got?
Yeah. So I thought it was a really cool idea when you decided to shot me message that you wanted to get this podcast together. This panel discussion together. And I guess for me, I will be, and I just knew this, I'll be the odd man out among the panel and probably our larger audience. I definitely consider myself contrary to the usual term, religious, not spiritual. I'm an increasingly Orthodox Sunni Muslim. Trying to practice more and more ever since I've really started, you know, crossing the threshold into practicing in my mid-20s. And it's certainly been a journey for me, as much of it's new-ish to me. I have been probably somewhat serious practicing for the past 10 years. And just, you know, as I've gotten on into, I guess, middle age now. I definitely think it's the right fit. I think it's something that I thought, having been very nominally born into the faith, you know, when I was born, I think it's something that I grew up thinking there was a distinct possibility that I would find myself interested in taking a religious turn. But I, you know, I think I'm among our crowd. And of course, you know, I don't know if it comes off very clearly, but my political and religious and overall views have really been in flux, even including since starting this podcast. And that's one of the reasons actually I wanted to start a podcast where we did primarily interviews. But I think I'm very heterodox among these groups for being more of an orthodox practitioner and not someone that has sort of a heterodox view of my chosen religious practices or denomination or whatever. But yeah, I think I have some pretty distinct reasonings that I've kind of been thinking about, reflecting on quite a bit since you announced to me that we were going to organize this panel discussion. And yeah, I'm kind of excited to hear what everybody has to say. My background is basically I grew up in a mixed, you know, one parent Muslim, one parent Christian family, both having grown up from. So there's that. We're starting there, and then both having grown up, you know, in families and in communities where religion is pretty moderately, but like very ever present. And in case I'm sure my dad went to some sort of religious schooling at some point in Pakistan where he grew up, and my mom definitely went to Christian school for most or all of or a lot of her. A lot of her schooling through high school. So like, but by the time they had me, there was, you know, religion. It was not like a purely secular. It's definitely not atheistic household, but there was really not a lot of practice. It was a very, very moderately religious. I did go to like religious based private schools at a very young age, like preschool, kindergarten age. And I was exposed to, you know, Islam and Protestantism and Judaism, like the practices of Judaism too. So I kind of grew up into an environment where there was definitely a strong acknowledgement of religion, and I really kind of respected it even from a very young age. But as I've grown older, I've really found Islam to be actually quite a good fit for me, and sort of, I guess, what I think makes sense religiously. So it's just exciting to see kind of how compare and contrast, I think, how many religiously observant or spiritually inclined libertarian anarchists and others kind of combine their whole worldview or kind of I don't want to say interpret because I hate when people use that word, but how they kind of position themselves when it comes to these things, because it can be touchy. It can be a very, you know, organized versus unorganized, spiritual versus religious, heterodox versus orthodox. There can be a lot of debates that I think people have when it comes to the religious and spiritual practices within our broader realm.
So Penguin's the weirdo amongst weirdos by being orthodox. I like it. I'll take it. I guess that leaves me. And man, since I scheduled this thing, I've been thinking about this and I don't fucking know. I was raised by like parents who were sort of hippy dippy woo woo, you know, vaguely atheist. They converted to Buddhism when I was in my young teens. So we used to get dragged to pagodas quite a bit. A lot of my early spiritual readings were getting into my father's books and stuff. And he had a lot of shit on shamanism and Carlos Castaneda and Eastern mysticism and Buddhism as well, and a lot of the sort of you know, the standard countercultural stuff like Herman Hesse and the Merry Pranksters and let's see. So that's kind of where I started. I think as a teenager, I probably identified in a number of different things. It's from Wiccan to Satanist to later on into Crowley quite a bit in my teens. And then from there I went into Hermeticism, and I'd spent a lot of years reading on Hermeticism. Now I don't know, man. yeah. I like what Shane said, you know, I like to be in nature. So whatever you call that. I think other people would probably define me as a chaos magician. I am a Pope of the Church of Discordia, but so is everyone else. I do enjoy the ethos of chaos magic, in the sense that I take what I like from things, from various practices and schools of thought, and I leave what I don't like. And I sort of relish in the sort of chaotic nature of the universe itself. And I think there's kind of beauty in that. And, you know, I've always been far more interested in these spaces than I've actually, you know, practiced. At least that's the way I thought of it for a long time. But sort of the older I get, the more I think of, like, you know, it's the old joke. It's just like going through the most mundane things in life and calling it magic. Because to me, like at this point, like everything's fucking magic. The psychology is magic. Self-help's magic. Thinking about things before you're doing it, setting your mind to it, and then getting it accomplished, that's magic. Me making kids is magic. Teaching my kids stuff is, to me, just everything is fucking magic in one way or another, especially, I guess, if you define it broadly enough, you know? So, this is a joke, but like basically my spiritual practice is like a possum screaming out its own ass, like flying through space. And, I joke, but that's probably not that far off. And, I don't know, man, like I don't have a word for my spiritual practice, if you can call it that. I mean, I have an altar and stuff, and we do some ritual magic, and I was married to my wife by like two wizards, who some of you were there for. So there's that. But honestly, I dabble everywhere here and there. I've just always been very interested in this space where, like, the esoteric philosophy, physics, quantum physics, and psychology sort of all meet, and there's so much overlap, and at a certain point they all sort of converge into where they all overlap and make references to each other. And I really have always just liked that space, and it's been very interesting to me. And you know, whether or not things are true or real or whatever the thing, it doesn't matter, in the sense that, like, I think it's valuable to keep things interesting and to think of the universe as way more malleable than we think it is. And it at least opens your mind to like other possibilities, and, keeps things, keeping things open-minded and making the impossible possible. I think it's good to at least have that mindset. At least that's worked for me. So the bottom line is I don't know what you would call what I do or what I'm interested in. So, yeah, that's my journey to where I'm at now anyway. Penguin brought up something, though, that I kind of wanted to reach out to all of you to ask all of you guys. That it seems that there's a growing number of, because we're all anarchists here, or ish. And there's a growing number of anarchists interested in spirituality or, you know, mental liberation. And it's like, what is it about anarchists that seem to be attracted to, I don't know, let's say alternative forms of spirituality? Like, does anybody have any thoughts on why that is?
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to butt in because it doesn't apply to me, but I think that's the first thing that came into my mind is that the vast majority, like you take a smattering of like people we know that might put on the peer or our audience. So like the greater, larger space of people to kind of discuss these ideas. And pretty clearly, like most people are going to have, I mean, very understandably, like even if they identify with a certain religious or especially if they just, so if they have, obviously if they identify as some sort of like vague or sort of undefined or like custom or personalized, if that makes any sense, sort of spiritual belief, then that's obviously one side of the coin. But as far as someone who might identify as a Christian or which is the most common, designation you find in these kind of spaces or in like either in libertarian or anarchist, anarchist-ish, like you said, you would see people with interpretations, and I kind of don't like when you say like I have my own interpretation of something, and I'll kind of get into that probably, but like different heterodox views or attitudes or just, you know, ways of positioning themselves with respect to their religious beliefs for those portion of people that kind of are aligned with a more structured kind of or organized religion, so to speak, that because a lot of the beliefs, I think, both in terms of dogma, in terms of like actual scripture, in terms of like the majority of practitioners and practice and within like the organized structures and hierarchies and like the in some religions of priesthood and some religions of this or that or the other, they kind of obviously sort of go against basic ideas of kind of an anarchistic principle. In many people's views, obviously, and very clearly in some cases. I mean, when you look at a highly structured religion, such as like, for example, the Catholic Church with a formal and centralized structure for the most part. I mean, I'm sure you could come up with one. You could hypothetically come up with a religion that's more formally, more centrally structured. You know, you clearly start to see, and I don't mean to pick on them or any particular religion at any point in this conversation, but you clearly see contrarian elements, and like my Islamic religion very clearly is highly authoritarian in many respects, and in many interpretations, you know, is essentially to some extent, some people even consider it more of a state than a religion itself. And so how, you know, but ironically from that perspective, the fortunes of, I think, of our faith practice, like the strength of our faith as a religion, has actually not been tied to political strength at all over time, or like the righteousness of the religious practitioners has not been tied to the righteousness or the allegiance to the religion, let's say of the political elements of political leaders. So there's actually quite a bit to say about any religion and our religion as far as organized and disorganized religion. But I think it's very easy to say, you know, organized religion is a hierarchical structure. It's something that has central authority, a certain level of central planning or social planning. And that's, is typically used for social control. It's typically used for, I mean, it is used for social control and control people via culture, via their life practices and everything. I mean, it's kind of undeniable. And we might kind of see it differently today now that we have sort of more totalitarian oriented states. And even at that point, I think we can start to see organized religions as more of like secondary institutions or as more of things that are, even if there is a level of hierarchy or authority, which is ultimately always going to be on some level voluntary, even if you tried to coerce it, that it'll never be as totalitarian as the modern interpretation, modern totalitarian nation state, and could very much offer a respite or an alternative to it. And I kind of lost the rest of my thoughts, but that's kind of, but I mean, the obvious choice for a radical individualist, especially, or someone that incorporates that, you know, into their ideology, is to kind of have their own radically individual viewpoint. So it's sort of kind of what I expected, me being the odd man out. And I think that's kind of cool because it happens quite often.
Yeah. I'll play off of what Penguin said. I think actually, and I've said this for some time, I've always found it odd when I first, you know, started my journey into anarchism. I always thought it was strange that, I mean, like the first thing I encountered was pretty much the Mises Institute. So it was anarcho-capitalism, you know, and so many of those guys were Catholic. And it kind of blew my mind. I'm like, wait a minute, like where does this hierarchy, like Penguin was talking about, you know, like how does that gel with everything I understand about the kind of the inherent nature, or what would be argued as the, you know, state of nature that exists, you know, within anarchism? I mean, you know, a lot of anarchists outside of, say, the Mises Institute would always say, you know, everybody's born an anarchist and an atheist, right? And it didn't make any sense to me until it clicked. And this, I think, is kind of playing off of what Penguin said, where I feel like it's for them, especially those, and I don't need to name names. We all know the names, but for some of those guys who get a lot of TV time and whatever, or even it was a Judge Napolitano. He was like a big deal on Fox News back in the day. And, you know, he's like admittedly an anarchist, but also a hardcore Catholic, also a judge. Which, whatever. But anyway, I think it was always for that type of person, it was especially somebody who's in the limelight, who has to give answers, basically saying, you know, I mean, and it blew my mind when Judge Napolitano said, you know, he was asked a question on Stossel, and they asked him, you know, what do we do about a Navy? And he said, who needs a Navy? Right? Now, that was awesome to hear him say that, like that on national television, no matter what channel it is, that's phenomenal. But I think that the cheat and conceit that they had was that when somebody would say, well, then how do we dispense justice? I think they could always say, well, don't worry about it. God will handle it. Or don't worry about it. The church will handle it, or the faith will handle it. And so I think for a lot of anarchists, or I shouldn't say a lot, but I think for, I'll just say many. Okay. Maybe that's the same thing, but I'll just say many. For many anarchists, I think it is the reserve justice system for when you do dissolve the state or don't recognize the state. And honestly, I see that as a failing. Like that's really, like I said, I use the word cheat. I think it's a cheat. You know, like you either improve the individual, or the individual either improves, or, you know, you can't rely on someone else coming to save you. I mean, that to me, that's one of the tenets of anarchism, is that no one's coming to save you. Now, conversely, I'll say quickly, I think the other part that attracts anarchists to spirituality is the exact same thing, is that spirituality can embolden, empower the individual to the point, depending upon what your belief system is, of course, to the point that you actually have dramatic control, maybe even on a universal, or, you know, on a galactic or universal scale, of what's happening around you. And you have to accept responsibility for that and also take action upon that. And I think that's a very powerful feeling, you know, especially when it's something that you practice individually. You know, I'm a big, and I guess I could speak quickly too on why I think there is a growing embracing of spirituality, particularly with libertarians and anarchists, as late. And I think there is. And really for a lot of people, not just anarchists and libertarians, but, you know, I've done a tech podcast for over 10 years, and I started doing a tech podcast because I felt that, okay, no, technology, like computers, all this stuff can really make, you know, one laptop can make an individual as powerful as any nation state. And I mean that, Like, and if you don't believe me, just look at the payouts, you know, to hackers or security professionals, you know, that the tech giants, Microsoft, Apple, whoever, you know, they'll pay millions of dollars if you find this one flaw in iOS or something like that. And that's because that one flaw in iOS makes you a very powerful individual. And all you need is a terminal open on your laptop to take advantage of it. Okay. So I felt, you know, over 10 years ago, like, no, technology is something, not that we have to necessarily be, you know, terrorists and, you know, engage in exploits and all this stuff. And I use the term terrorist with quotes there, because who's really the terrorist? The state, obviously. But, you know, I felt that that was technology was empowering the individual and making the individual, you know, even in some ways more powerful than the authoritarian structures that exist around them. The problem is, in the past 10 years, and part of the reason that I've actually shifted in recent years to talking more about spirituality, is that technology is not going in that direction. Technology is going the opposite direction, where it's not empowering the individual anymore. Now it's just empowering the state and empowering corporatism. And the individual's ability to take advantage of technology is increasingly shrinking. And I think a lot of people, either consciously or unconsciously, are realizing this. And so they are going to a more ancient technology than electronics and computers, and they're going to spirituality to do so. And I think it's a great thing.
I want to play off a little bit on what you said, because I think you're right when you say that it's a cheat to use it as some sort of alternative remaining judgment system. I think really what it ends up being, it's similar in description, but instead of a judgment system, it should be an internal framework. And I think regardless of what philosophy you follow, well, I'll just put it this way. Anarchists, you rarely see someone who only identifies as just anarchist. There's usually some sort of hyphenation in there. You know, so it's a Christian anarchist, an agorist anarchist, a mutualist anarchist, an egoist anarchist. There's all sorts of different sub frameworks. And most people within the anarchist space do identify with at least one of these alternative frameworks. I think that's a huge part of it. So like for me, particularly with Christian anarchism, the modeling oneself after the example set by Jesus is so huge and so all encompassing as far as like having a moral framework that it's so encompassing as far as moral frameworks go that the more you express an anarchistic position, the more you have to express whatever framework it comes from. So whatever framework you come from, I mean. So like treat others as you would like to be treated, the golden rule. Basically, everyone has that one. Turn the other cheek as far as Christianity is concerned. There's a lot of individual things. I can get into them later. But the main position here, I think, is that anarchism is a privation of that authority structure overhead. And that is like a maw opening up beneath you in a certain sense, because you don't have that state framework, because the state has become the enemy. You finally recognize that the state is there to subjugate you and to take what you have. No one is coming to save you. That is correct. So you have to rely on a framework of some kind in order to orient yourself, whether that be anarcho-capitalism and the advantages of profit, or the NAP, or anarcho-communism and the benefits of collectivism, you know, voluntary collectivism, whether that is any sort of other sort of market anarchism or egoism, where it is, you know, whatever pleases the unique within you. Yeah, these are all different frameworks that
anarchism is a privation of the state. And so, you know, if you don't hyphenate with something, you're left with nothing. I would say that most people who don't identify with some sort of hyphenated anarchism of any kind, even if they haven't identified that the identification, they probably have one and they are just either blind to their own reality and their own internal value structure, or they're, you know, basically relying completely and solely on themselves and their own judgment whatsoever, which, well, good fucking luck with that, buddy.
I mean, I don't hyphenate. I mean, if I did hyphenate, I'd have a fucking list the size of my arm. You know, like there's lots of value that I find in lots of different anarchist thought. And you might say it's nothing, but to quote like Novatore, it's a creative nothing. You know, I don't need a presupposed structure, so to speak. I think a lot of things could be sort of made up as we go, ad hoc, so to speak. But that's just me. I like things messy, I guess. I wanted to add something here because I think this is might crystallize a point that everybody's making. So I've said this before, but you know, I was a young lad and my parents were sort of political radicals, right? So I was very politically aware of what was going on in the world. I had no fucking innocence as a child, you know, very aware of like Reagan shipping crack into the fucking ghetto and just all the horrible shit that was going on as a lad. And also my parents were pretty abusive. So as a teen, like I was fucking angry and depressed and all this kind of shit, just mad at the fucking world, you know? And I stumbled into a lot of like, philosophy and a lot of like, Taoism and a lot of stoicism. And, you know, I don't agree with a lot of stoicism now, but at the time there's a concept in stoicism that's, it's like spheres of influence. So what I was doing and what was making me so fucking angry, or a large part of it, that, and my parents were assholes, but like a greater part of that was I was focusing very much on things that were very far away that I had fucking little I could do about. Right. So when I understood that the most control you have is over what's in your own fucking mind first, and then you can start, once you get that situated, you can start to work yourself out from there, and then you can control the things that are going around in your immediate surroundings, and then maybe in your community, and then once you get all that situated, now you can really actually maybe make change. But at that point, it's sort of an inside joke among alchemists, the transmutation happens in your fucking mind. It's not about turning lead into gold. It's the, you know, the fucking friends you make along the way, right? It's the change happens in you first, right? So and then that change echoes outward, and you know, some might say it echoes out into the fucking universe or into eternity and all these sorts of things, and that may be fucking true. But in the meantime, it's really beneficial for your putting your own shit in order first, and you're getting your own mind right, so you can actually engage with reality in sort of a healthy way, and to make things happen the way you want them to happen, and to make things around you happen that you want to happen. But that all starts with, like, you can't focus far away first, because it'll just fucking eat you up inside, and you'll just care about things that you feel and be sad and angry about things that you have no fucking control over whatsoever. So for me, Stoicism and Taoism, and I know it's pronounced Tao, but if you talk to some Taoist, they'll pronounce it Tao as well. It's just the same word. It doesn't have an English translation. It's very similar in Tao, where it's like, you can't change the Tao. All you can do is change yourself. And there's live in accordance with your true nature and all these sorts of things. And that was also very helpful, because again, it comes back to that internal fucking work. You're not going to change the world, but And if you try, it's just going to fucking eat you up and spit you out. But what you can do is change yourself. And then you find out later, like, oh, actually, if you change yourself, you could probably change the world. And or at least make it, you build your, create your own fucking world. And that was useful to me. And I think that's kind of what everybody's hinting at here. That's what a theme that I keep hearing in everybody's, what everybody's saying. So I think that's the sort of goes in hand with why anarchists look for spiritual practices that, yes, one, are individual, but are two, like I always said, an internal framework, something that you can use to, you know, organize your own mind and your own life and your own, you know, behaviors and relationships and that sort of thing. And sure, it'll absolutely influence your thoughts about anarchism, but also just it'll affect your own life. But I'll leave it there. Does anybody have anything to add to that?
One other point, and I think this will go right to Rayo here, and that is because I think he might be able to speak to this best, but the abject failure, I mean, it's been longer than the past 4 years, but the abject failure of the past 4 years of the Western medical system is, I mean, you want to talk about a reason people are getting into spirituality, you know, wow. I think everybody's looking at alternatives here. And Rayo, I'm sure you could speak to this better than all of us.
I guess that wasn't where I was thinking about going, but that actually is, yeah, that is true. I mean, that is a big thing. I mean, I think people have realized this isn't necessarily just like a material physical sort of war or battle. It might actually be like mental, or it might actually be spiritual, like with, you know, with what transpired in 2020. Some people have definitely taken that perspective. That's and then seeing the ramifications of what transpired over that couple of years, past couple of years, is certainly probably you know, brought some people to Jesus, or other avenues like that. 100%, for sure. I suppose the thing that came to mind a little bit ago, Brian, that you brought up, or I'm kind of responding to you on this one, but I guess the additional liberation you can find in the spiritual realm, because I know looking at Vanu and like Vanu's, you know, a lot of it's physical liberation, and I think a number of folks, you know, I guess in my circles that, you know, have experienced some sort of physical liberation, and that you see how much, as we've been discussing, you see how much power you have to create freedom in your life, and once you see how empowered you can be in the physical realm, and you start diving into some of these other avenues, I mean the mental and spiritual realms are critical to higher forms of liberation, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Depending upon perspective, you know, if you're more from like a Gnostic or ancient Essene tradition, you might be trying to actually escape, escape the simulation. But if you come more from like a karma reincarnation cycle vantage point, like a lot of the fear surrounding, you know, living and existing in this highly coercive world, it kind of disappears. Death, disease, you go to jail, like whatever, like you'll be back next life, to make the coercer's lives hell. So it's like, it removes a lot of fear, which, again, like why I spiritual self-liberation is kind of my vantage point from this. And, if you embrace that, if you embrace that or inspired by that, it's certainly powerful, certainly powerful. And I guess I'll just drop in one other thing that I guess one other trend I've seen, which has been weird over the past few years. But and I guess I'll just say conspiracists like YouTubers or content creators. No, I don't mean conspiracists in a negative sense, but it's a shorthand. But there have been quite a few, I guess, like some of those folks, and even libertarians who are moving to like Russian Christian Orthodoxy, which which is kind of strange to me, at least. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
I could kind of understand that going to Eastern Orthodox. I haven't really seen it, but I could understand it just from the sense that, you know, I think the term Catholic, you know, comes with a lot of very negative baggage. Even though, like I said, in libertarian circles, obviously some of the biggest names in libertarianism are, you know, hardcore Catholic, but it's still Eastern Orthodox. I mean, here's the thing, like even in my life, at one point I was attracted to Catholicism. Why? Because it's like the most epic role play I've ever seen. I mean, it's people walking around like it's World of Warcraft, you know, speaking in different languages and everything. I mean, like the Tridentine Mass is gorgeous. It's a gorgeous human invention. And I think that a lot of people go to Eastern Orthodox because, okay, it's like Catholic light. Like, okay, yeah, they worship paintings. That's kind of strange. But also, I think another attractive point of Eastern Orthodox would be that, you know, they don't try to translate the Book of Revelation because that's what scares a lot of people. And I think it's why a lot of people actually might be even standoffish with Christianity. But, you know, I mean, with Catholicism, the Book of Revelation is, it's more or less kind of already happened. The church is here and it's just got to get, you know, whatever, perfected. But for Eastern Orthodox, you know, their general belief is, yeah, the Book of Revelation is a mystery. We don't have a goddamn clue what it means. And maybe they wouldn't use the word goddamn, but regardless, I think that those couple aspects of it, the structure, the beauty, the even the role play, whether people want to consciously or unconsciously admit to that, you know, and then kind of eliminating the scariness of the Book of Revelation, I think it's an attractive proposition to a lot of people. Especially longtime anarchists, if they've tried to play without quote unquote rules or structure for a very long time and they didn't feel like it improved their life. And so now they're looking for something. They don't want it to be the state. They know better, but they want something. And I could see where Eastern Orthodox would be attractive there. Maybe we could speak more to that.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, the Book of Revelation is actually part of what I can consider to be a strong position for a strong source for someone to take an anarchist position, actually. That plus the book of First Samuel. Now you have that Jewish history in you. So yeah. You're probably familiar with First Samuel 8.
Oh, of course. You don't want a king. Yeah,
no, absolutely not. Well, basically the Christian anarchist position is that it's anarchist on earth, monarchist in heaven. That's kind of the breakdown of it. So as far as Book of Revelation goes, like that's just like imagine if the state could legitimately be truly perfect. Obviously, you know, from a Christian perspective, and for the most part from a Jewish perspective, especially when you look at the time of Noah, there in Genesis, the whole source of it is that humanity is essentially got an evil core to ourselves. The doctrine of sin, if I remember right, is the correct terminology for that. The doctrine of sin nature, or, you know, that's basically what my entire podcast is based on, you know, the Antichrist. So I'll break that down real quick. Because it's kind of central to this, in Christian theology, there's the Trinity, the theory that I've come up with, and this is something I've legit coined myself, and I've had, priests from both Orthodoxy and Catholicism say that they could probably affirm this if I put it into, some sort of significant document. So I'm pretty sure I'm onto something here. Oh, and Protestants too. Basically, it's that the idea that the Antichrist is there to mock God in all possible ways, and that includes mocking him in a structural sense. So the Trinity is also being mocked. So there's the nature of the Antichrist, which mocks God. There is the body of the Antichrist, which mocks Christ. And then there is the spirit of the Antichrist, which mocks the Holy Spirit. These things conglomerate together to become sort of a faux god that's internal, that all of us essentially follow when we follow our own most basest I mean that in the negative sense, in the bad sense, base, not based, most based
kind of desires.
Yeah. So that's sort of the core of it. And so when somebody follows that sort of pure selfishness that's exemplified from not accepting the greatest sacrifice that could be done, because even if you don't believe in the resurrection or any of that, most people still affirm that Jesus was incredibly wise, beyond his years. And one of my favorite lines that he says, what greater what greater love is there than to put one's life out for their friends, than to die for their friends? That is such a wonderful line. And not recognizing that sacrifice from another person, whether it be Christ or whether it be a father dying for his children or a brother dying for his sister or other siblings, or even just your buddy in war jumping on top of a grenade to save his squad. Like this, not recognizing that would be the purest of evils. And so when it comes to the book of Revelation, that's sort of that sort of protection, that dying for your friends, not recognizing that, is such a great evil that to see those people be put to the sword for that evil is, I wouldn't say it violates any sort of, because it basically is a NAP violation, in my opinion. Like when you follow that logic down the train, not respecting the sacrifice that somebody puts out, that is the precondition for continuing on to violating the NAP. If you're a NAP kind of guy.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, enjoy naps.
Yeah. Take it away, Zach. Nap.
Yeah. No, go ahead. That was it. I was going to interrupt you. You had something?
No. Well, I was going to add in, I think the core of really any religion or any spiritual structure really comes down to, it can actually be one of two things. Okay. It can either be an authoritarian structure where it's, you know, top down telling you what you should and shouldn't do, you know, and all of this, or to the whims of someone else, to the whims of those at the top, you know. So you're being controlled. You're not actually following your own heart. The other direction that religion can go, or that I would say it should, is it's something that enhances the human experience. And I feel like there are many things, many ancient practices that have carried down, you know, to this day. There are aspects of it that, you know, I think you can clearly see, okay, no, this is about, you know, the whim of, this is about someone else's desire. This is about what someone else wants, not about, you know, me connecting with myself and with nature more. But then, and I think some of those things can go away. I think we lose sight that there's a lot of these ancient, you know, a lot of the more ancient aspects of spirituality are products of their time. They're, you know, we're missing the context of what they're about. And are we going into kind of full circle? Like, you know, I thought it was interesting to bring up, you know, Samuel, the prophet Samuel, and how he was basically saying, you know, you don't know what you're asking for. You know, he's talking to the ancient Israelites. You don't know what you're asking for. You don't need a king. You don't want a king. You know, to say whether or not the system that existed before was that much better is a bit up to debate with the judges. And then how much is that even real history? That's a whole other thing too. But I do think we lose sight of the context of what a lot is getting talked about in these ancient religions. And part of the reason that I bring that up is that it can feel like this stuff does not apply to me today. And also you have a lot of people that take advantage of varying messaging or will ignore messages, perhaps like what was being talked about before. I think we really have to focus in on, I guess ultimately what I'm saying is we have to focus in on the context of the time frame of the time. And in some ways, when we're talking about liberation, you know, what matters to us now? What within any of this is important to the individual today, and then kind of build out from that. I have a hard time with the really rigid structure of, and I know, you know, Penguin's very much, you know, on the Quran is, is as it is, and I understand that. But I'll admit, I've a really, you know, we're talking about like the Book of Revelation and everything. I have a very hard time in believing that these things are relevant, are always relevant for all time as they're put down in, and I say this respectfully, in these stodgy old books. Just as humans evolve, you know, again, I know, like it said, there was a time where Israel, say, didn't need a king. And it seems like as anarchists, we're back to the point where, no, we don't want a king. We don't want people over us. We don't want this. But ultimately, we do evolve. We grow. We become smarter. We change the way that we interact with each other. We treat each other better, hopefully, and so on. And so I really like, and I want to hear other people's take on this, ultimately, that do you feel that the messaging in whatever book is the book of your choice, like, is really still relevant today? Or do you think that the words are like, it's a living document and the words kind of change their meaning over time? Like, I'd really love to hear that, because again, you know, I think a lot of people do, especially in anarchism and libertarianism and so on, they do look for a book. I mean, some people go to Ayn Rand and they're like, no, everything that she says is code and rule, you know? And I get that. It's attractive to want to find that one book that tells you everything of how the universe works. But I mean, do we really think that kind of book could even exist?
No.
Wow. There we go.
No.
Yeah. Go ahead. Zach. Okay. Right, so I'll be brief. I think, and in response to just that last part, that's why I'll be brief. I'm just going to respond to that very last thing. I think that, you know, we're meant to, you know, I mean, how do I put this? We're not necessarily meant to know how everything in the universe works. And if we do discover, obviously we have quite a bit of scientific knowledge now, pretty crazy amount. And we certainly have the ability to reason and discover things, but I don't think that the goal of my faith, and it's pretty clear, is to, I mean, on one hand, compared to essentially any other religion, there's pretty much a dogmatic focus on, governing every single aspect of every human action and relation and stuff like that, to an extent. I mean, there's nuance to that, of course. It's certainly not open to absolute infinite individual interpretation, but at the same time, I don't think it's very kind of also dealing with the material world, and there's certainly theology and maybe even some aspects of what you might call mysticism there. But it's mainly tied to the actual physical world. It's not really trying to, you know, the Quran and obviously the Sunnah, other than some 40 more theological or mystical, might not be the right word, but hadiths, that it very much deals with the practical and physical world, and the very, even to the point of very mundane aspects of physical reality, over sort of being overly spiritual, mystical, focused on the, what's the word? I'm trying, metaphysical. And there obviously is a very robust, forms of Islamic metaphysics, whatever, even metaphysics. I'm not even quite sure what the word metaphysics means, but like in terms of very high level Islamic learning, which is similar to like very high level Catholic scholarship, for example. I mean, very extremely high level sort of academics scholarship, I guess that's the word, but we kind of use the word scholarship a little differently. But the bulk of the Islamic religion is exoteric. Especially, I guess that's my focus. I mean, there are definitely people that are very interested in metaphysics, very interested in a whole lot of things, and a lot of people that kind of form their identity online around those things are very interested in those concepts. And I respect that. And the people that are scholars and spend literally their entire lives studying these things, for them, it's a little different. A lot of that is still also based on the quote-unquote Islamic sciences and like not just on metaphysics, but on like jurisprudence and stuff that's still more grounded sort of in human relations and interpret and logical interpretations, a reason interpretations of the religious corpus or like the religious law. But like the majority of, for the most of us that are not in that category of people, the vast majority of the Islamic religion is very strictly to an outsider, to anybody in not a Muslim in living in our society. So anybody basically listening to this, very strictly from that perspective, governing the mundane aspects of human life. And I think that's kind of what appeals to me, first of all, is that those are the questions that most of us have to answer. And some of us, that don't want that structured, that kind of structure. I mean, I didn't mean to go kind of into this topic, but I mean, just to touch on why I do like that structure and that authority is basically, there is the aspect, and I think most people that would identify as libertarian or certainly that would identify themselves as anarchists, and I've never really used the term anarchist. I use the term anarchy since it's over anarchism, because there is a kind of a disconnect between me and a lot of people. I don't dislike structure or discipline or and it's similar to when it comes to individualism. I don't think that means that I eschew communitarianism, as I don't think those are necessarily up. I'm really talking about monopolistic coercion. I'm talking about very narrowly defined state power. And that would ruffle a lot of anarchist feathers. But I do think that even if you do not want the strongest and most structured form of dogmatic religion, that nobody, I mean, the vast, vast majority of people, and there are people, and there are people maybe in this, certainly anybody in this chat has been exposed to ideas of just absolutely going it alone and withdrawing from kind of dealing with people day to day and the varying aspects of society that do require some constraints on our actions. But for the vast majority of people, that's what are now considered in relation to the state as secondary institutions, secondary organizations, besides the family, which is most all ubiquitous. We're all basically born in some level of families, and then we have chosen family too. But like some level of secondary institutions on up from the family to a strong friend group all the way up to a strictly organized religion to the point of the Catholic Church, which starts to historically at different times blend itself into like a state, at least by like a pretty broad definition. But on some level, those secondary institutions like fraternal organizations and various churches and religious orders and orders of any sort, and clubs and so on and so forth, are, I think, very important to give ourselves our life structure, and they should and will have a lot of trouble kind of avoiding a lot of pitfalls if they aren't ultimately voluntary and not strictly compulsory. And I think that kind of does lend itself back to the aspect of liberty. But of course, a lot of people would disagree with that need for structure dogma and that kind of organized aspect of societal relations.
I'll be pretty brief on this one. as far as timelessness is concerned, you mentioned the historical context, Brian. I think that doing research and preserving and maintaining the understanding of a historical context, that is what makes it timeless. Because the more you go into the past and try to understand the historical context, the more you can figure out the actual base moral being described. So, for example, they didn't have the internet back then, obviously. But there's still plenty of morals that can be found in the Torah or the gospel or even the Quran or the Vedas or the Tao Te Ching. They all were relevant in their cultural context. That context doesn't exist anymore, but an understanding of that context can provide a more broken down form of what's trying to be communicated as a moral, and then can be applied to modern times. Like, so for example, in the Old Testament, there are a bunch of, and you've probably heard this one, and you might even agree at how annoying it is, that there are rules for how slave masters are to treat their slaves in the Old Testament. And a lot of people use that as some sort of reason that, that Christianity and Judaism, to another extent, support slavery, but they clearly don't. It's just, you know, these rules were written for their time, but they're written to communicate a specific kind of ethos. And that ethos translated into the future actually provides a stronger position than what was initially described. So, for example, with the Jews and their the rules that they had for slavery, if you actually went out of your way to capture a slave in ancient Israel, that was a death sentence. Now, you could buy one, but like, it was literally, you know, if you go out of your way to find someone, hunt them down and enslave them and keep them as your servant, that's the death penalty. And so despite the fact that there are rules on how to be nice to your slaves, that it's still pretty obvious that over time that these rules evolve. These rules improve, these rules get better. And I think that's part of what Jesus's example was he was supposed to be the perfect version, and that we are on our way moving towards that from where we were, that God works over time, or morality gets better over time, if you want to de-theologize it. So by understanding the cultural context, you get a more accurate view of the moral that was being communicated. And by getting that accurate view of the moral that's being communicated, you can figure out whether that was an endgame moral or an evolved moral from a previous position. And so you can figure out the correct direction to go from that. And I think the reason that these texts maintain their value over time is specifically the reason that they survive over time is because these morals, as they evolve over time, maintain a certain ethos that should be improving the lives. So, for example, for something Penguin could probably relate to, you're Sunni, so you don't believe in Muta, but the Shia do. And the Sunni tend to look down on the Shia for believing in Muta, because, you know, if I remember right, according to Hadiths, it was abrogated. That, again, is another evolution of the rule, of an original rule getting better over time. That, you know, prostitution is wrong, so we temporarily marry. That's a slight step up, but it's not going all the way to what it should be, where marriage shouldn't be dissolved at all. And that's sort of that moral directionism that's supposed to be maintained over time. Where the difficulty comes in is and this will make Penguin mad, the interpretation of where the moral is going in the long run. So that's usually the harder part. And that's when you get sectarianism between, you know, different sects of any religion or even non-religious philosophical position.
Yeah, you touched on slavery, which is a real big low-hanging fruit for any of the three so-called Abrahamic faiths, and a big one for Islam. I mean, as you know, as many Muslim people of many Muslim majority regions are in many Islamically, you know, many states ran by Muslims were very prolific. slavers, slave owners, slave traders, et cetera. And tends to be something that's seen as very, by a certain number of people that are like strongly opposed, you know, denouncing, you know, especially in modern times, Islam, and some, like, I think the word is polemicist. I don't want to use this one, but certain people would like to say, yes, we need, I mean, obviously these people were generally seen as pretty extreme, especially for one reason or another. That Islam is a very strongly pro-slavery and pro-enslavement religion. And it kind of boils down to to an outsider to be some very highly and this is interesting because it's pretty much the same story as the other religions, but some very highly contradictory indicators where, in fact, there's a lot of acknowledgement of slavery. Like you said, there's a lot of acknowledgement of slavery, which is a practice that was commonplace almost in the entire world at the time and continued to be for centuries and centuries after this time. It would be you would really have to question a God that did not address justice around slavery. And, you know, of course, the obvious answer is why, but you would also often find this answer from people that are very far from the religion or atheistic themselves, is like, why didn't God just ban slavery? And I think, you know, I don't know how that would work, but I think you have to say in his infinite knowledge. But the rules around slavery were very simple. And the example of the prophet, peace and blessings upon him, very simple. You know, did not eat in front of a slave. Well, he did not eat in front of a slave without offering the food and so forth and so on and so forth. And there were many rules and many limitations of. That actually is not about the rights of the slaves, but many limitations on the person owning the slave, and an increase. But very importantly, freeing a slave is one of the most important and most, in terms of good deeds, the most righteous deeds that you can do, that you can put on your book of deeds in your life for the afterlife. Like, freeing a slave is like a necessity. And yes, you must have slaves, because many people did have slaves, and many people that did have slaves were wealthy people who may have, through their like just increased influence in the world, have accrued many, many bad deeds, many, many sins. And to free a slave would give them a tremendous amount of good deeds. So there's always a certain incentive for people to, you know, when I take a religion that does not say slavery is hereby forbidden forever, and say, well, then we're going to go capture slaves, and I guess I'll have my sins forgiven another way. But it's very clear that freeing a slave, or marrying a slave in the sense of elevating that person up to a wife, not holding a female slave as a concubine, et cetera, is considered a very righteous thing to do. And these things move on. So I've seen a very good discussion of why Muslims do not seek to own slaves. I mean, I think it's pretty clear answer is that it's very unpopular. There's been a worldwide abolition of slavery, and it would be considered barbaric. The only reason it really struck that it's actually religiously, it's not even religion, but it's practically based, is very one. The world that existed when slavery was not abolished, you know, by the Islamic religion or by any other previous religion, existed. You were likely to be a slave, and most of those people were very easily susceptible to be taken as a slave. And when you lived out in the world, you're thinking of yourself as, oh, should I not take a slave? If slavery is accepted, you have a very good chance. And if you live in a world where your part of the world is actually undergoing strife and conflict, you're more likely to be taken as a slave. And your wife could be taken as a slave. Your son and daughter could be taken as a slave. So the law hasn't changed, but the reality around that has actually changed. Nobody's required to do any of these things. I'm kind of going off on a tangent. But in that aspect, that doesn't change what I'm trying to make is in that aspect that the word hasn't changed. There is no new interpretation. There's no reinterpretation. There's no saying that, a salad bar kind of, I'm taking this and leaving that. I'll respect this aspect of the religion, or I'll take this scripture, but I reject this scripture, or this book doesn't no longer count as our scripture, or we're going to find a new book to add to our scripture or anything like that. And that's probably something I'll go into why it's like the Islamic religion is very important. If you do take the existence of God and his revelation very seriously as like a real thing that essentially materially exists. But you haven't changed anything based on your whim or because you don't like this certain thing and you don't like what's being said about that. But there's also the very real practical reality that you can easily come to a better result and actually come to like a meaningful evolution of certain ideas and practices and the justice, the overall justice of society itself, without actually changing what's supposed to be and what says itself is inviolable.
Yeah. I want to touch on this. So as far as, because right, all three Abrahamic faiths, you know, do dive deep onto slavery, and it seems like there is a condemnation, but then there isn't, you know, and you get into like the Book of Romans by Paul and what is he saying, and, you know, give what Caesar to Caesar, all this jazz. I think something that is widely missed is that many times these things that quote unquote God gives, say in the Abrahamic books, are concessions to human understanding. Now I don't believe, and actually Judaism, Judaism, regardless of, denomination, we'll say, you know, there isn't this belief in like original sin. There isn't this belief in necessarily a good or evil. I mean, there's things called evil, but this idea that somehow humanity is inherently evil, you know, due to Adam's sin, like that's not really part of the program. You might find some rabbis that would say that, because at the very heart of Judaism is just rabbis arguing with each other. You know, there's no actual like real agreement, but regardless, there isn't really this like good or evil that exists within any of this. What there is, and really when we're talking about slavery, we can cut at the core of it. And also, I think it kind of speaks to why people aren't really anarchists. What there is human laziness. And that seems to be an inherent aspect of being human, is being lazy. In fact, it's a funny thing. In Judaism, they call it the Yetzer Hara, which is the evil inclination. Now, the funny part of it is that the Yetzer Hara is not considered a bad thing. Even though it's called the evil inclination, it's considered a good thing. It's like rabbis will say, without the Yetzer Hara, you know, man would never, he'd never make a house. He'd never have sex. He'd never, like, he just wouldn't do anything. He'd be lazy if he didn't have this evil inclination. Okay. And so, you know, why do you need slaves in the first place? Again, in some ways, I think it's because you're lazy or because of a lack of desired responsibility. And that gets to the point of, you know, why I think a lot of people actually, there's always more than one reason, but one of the reasons that a lot of people don't become anarchists is because they want these structures around them that are going to just take care of them. And so they don't have to think about it and they don't have to handle it. If you haven't figured it out, I'd put the egoist anarchist right there for me. So anyway, a lot of these things are concessions to humanity. You know, for myself in Judaism, I always say the best thing that ever happened to my people is that the Second Temple was destroyed. And I say that because once the Second Temple was destroyed, suddenly there's no more central point of failure. And suddenly every Jew or every believer, whatever you want to ascribe to, okay, is responsible for their own sin, their own faith, their own whatever, their own problems, their own rejoices. You're responsible for all of that. And that's really, including within the Abrahamic books, you know, when you read like Jeremiah 33, where it says, you know, there will be a new covenant and the law will be written in their hearts. Basically, what it's saying is, no, there's no law. You're going to evolve. You're going to get past the stuff. You're not going to need the concessions anymore. You don't need the temple anymore. You don't need slaves anymore. You don't need this anymore. You don't even need me anymore, quote unquote, God. and you can go forward. And I think that gets missed a lot. And it's part of why I asked the question is that I think, you know, people read a lot of weird things. It's like, why are all these laws? I don't care about this. This doesn't happen anymore. This isn't the deal. And that's actually almost a good sign in that, no, you've evolved this far. Keep going. Okay. Because you don't need these concessions anymore. If people looked at it in that way, I think they'd see it again as very empowering and honestly very liberating. That you've become so much more. I mean, we used to have to, we had, you know, in Judaism, there's a law to wash your hands when you eat. And it's like, who needs a law for that anymore? Right. we all do that now, you know, or make sure, you know, you clean things at a certain temperature and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, we all have dishwashers that do that anyway. Basically everybody lives by the law of Moses anymore. They just are today and they don't know it, you know, because it's just, we just understand. We've evolved and we understand. We don't need the law. And that's a really liberating concept, in my opinion, that when you apply that within spirituality, I think then you can also take that to the state and boom, spiritual anarchists. Sec, what do you got?
Well, I'm going to throw it to Rayo here in a second, but we're coming up on the hour and a half mark and we've barely fucking scratched the surface of anything yet. So,
oh my God, you're right.
Yeah, seriously. So do all of you, would all of you be down for a part two of this?
Absolutely.
Totally. Okay.
100%.
Cool. All right, cool.
I could keep going, but I don't want to like,
I think we all could keep going for another 4 hours.
For our listeners' sake. Yes. Attention spans, I totally think that would make a lot more sense and get our points across a little better too.
Okay, cool. All right, let's plan on doing that and I'll set it up. But
we could talk about this subject for countless hours. There's literally
talking about this shit for thousands of years.
Yeah, you know thousands of years.
Right.
So, right. But Rayo, you had something before we kind of wrap up.
Yeah, so I'm not sure why I didn't think about this initially, but in terms of like why spirituality is critical to liberation and, you know, just regardless, you know, like I guess spirituality in the context of liberation. This is one of the very early episodes on the Vani podcast where I switched to anything like this. But it was episode 94 on ancient second realms. And I just stumbled across this old Rosicrucian Temple of Illuminati document. My old conspiracy self, obviously, my red flags went off. And then I started reading it. It was originally published in like 1910, by the way, so it's pretty old. But it was based off kind of the, I guess, the Dead Sea Scrolls, that sort of thing. But it discussed the Essenes and the pre-Christ Christians. And Brian, I think they were actually, very early Jews, too. Anyone back then was, like, I guess any Christian back then was a Jew. I think it was, as far as
sure,
from reading these things. But I started reading it. I didn't know what to expect, but it was anti-war. It was pro-life, you know, pro-humanity. It sounded like it was written by an anarchist, literally. And from coming, again, you know, coming from, like, a Bill Cooper perspective where all the secret societies are bad, it was a shockwave, I guess you could say. But, yeah, it literally could have been written by an anarchist, for sure. But, of course, the details, we've been talking a lot tonight about details and context. They seem to be from a different time, but regardless, and I'll just for the featured image for this episode, it's like two sentences, but quote, the solution which the Essenes offered for economic and social harmony can be applied in every age, the present as well as the past. It contained four factors. One, separating from the chaotic conditions of the mass of mankind which refused to obey natural and cosmic law, and end quote. That's all I've got in the featured image. But if we're talking about how spirituality can directly impact, spirituality in terms of liberation, this is the most practical thing that I've, and it was kind of mind blowing because I just started, you know, doing the Paznia thing at that time, building a parallel network, and you know, coming across this, and again, like I'm not a scholar on these sorts of things. I can't necessarily verify the authenticity of a lot of this, but regardless. This was an important thing, for me, that it's not only the spirituality is great, you know, in and of itself, but You know, the morals and ethics can guide you in physical space and time right now. It doesn't really matter, you know, what's happening. It doesn't really matter what could transpire, you know, what the ramifications from your actions are, because living in these sorts of ways is contrary to the servile society now, as I call it, and as it's been called by Rayo and Benuans and such. But it's always relevant. It's always here. Like if we have whatever the respective principles espoused to are, you know, spiritual law can be a major guide and bring those into physical space and time. It's definitely a great motivator. And you know, finding historicity to something like that was pretty sweet. So I guess that's pretty much all I have. Yeah, I don't know, like I said earlier, like the spirituality was something I really did not care about for a long time, more the mental liberation part. But it is just as much important to the physical liberation part, if not more important. Which is why I'm here today, and I'm excited that we're going to continue this conversation. So yeah, that's all I got.
Well, dope. I just want to address.
Go ahead.
Hold on. Because I wanted to elaborate on my no earlier, and it's not that. I didn't mean no in the sense that, like, there can't be things written thousands of years ago that are not important today or timeless or, you know, basic truisms, so to speak, right? That, of course, exists. But for me personally, you know, and it's not just true for spirituality, it's true for philosophers and historians and whoever, you know, I don't find myself agreeing with anyone 100% ever. Not even my wife, and she's the smartest person I know, and we don't agree, and we live together, and it's fine, you know. But I don't find myself agreeing with spiritual texts 100% all the time either. And there's some stuff that just it doesn't, you know, jive with me for whatever reason, you know. And I think these things, you know, it comes back to subjective values, right? You know, it's just what works for me, you know. And it might work for somebody else, might not. But sure, texts from thousands or tens of thousands of years can absolutely be applied today. But at the, you know, it's very rare that I'll find something where I will agree with everything in a body of work, because you got a lot of authors' personal biases and different slants and things you just don't agree, flat out don't agree with. But then there's some things that you might find value in or that drive with me, you know. And that's how I kind of, not just with spirituality, but with everything, that's how I deal with basically everything. I take what I like and I leave what I don't, and it's fine. And that's sort of what makes like humanity beautiful, in a sense that, yeah, you know, there's something for everybody, and everybody's got their different thing and their own true will, or they're unique or whatever the thing. And, you know, it's value subjective, and so are most things. So, and that's the other reason that sort of spirituality is, I think, important for the anarchist project. Is it keeps things interesting, keeps your imagination of like what is possible wide open, and to keep, you know, keep shit fun and weird. And I think that that can drive people to consider, even anarchists to consider alternatives that maybe they never thought of, and also just be like a fucking kinder person, which I think can be not only a good thing to do, but fucking very useful for achieving a post-state society. So that's enough on that. And here's somebody else take it. I got a screaming child here.
Okay, I'll just want to kind of address one point that I didn't really get a chance to make. Going off of the idea of like the organized religion and the very like obviously contradictory nature to like kind of like organized religion to the people that are, for the most part, attracted to these sorts of ideas, at least at first. So on a surface level, like at first glance, you would say, I mean, and not just at first glance, I'm not saying that if you continue along that sort of belief that you haven't really looked deep enough into these sort of issues of liberty and everything. And I've evolved on this. I mean, I didn't know what direction I was going to go and incorporating an overall worldview when I started on this sort of political or parapolitical project, and the same with my, you know, religious practices. But in terms of like whether, you know, the kind of the rejection of organized religion as being a tool of control, I mean, this is pretty much every single person in society knows this basic concept. And most people have, I think just almost every single person in society, with very few exceptions, has at least on some level sort of eschewed, you know, traditional organized religion compared to its heyday. Pretty much the entire society has pretty much eschewed most of organized religion compared to its heyday, when it was very much tied to the state. But my one way to address it, that is this, as organized religion as a tool of control, as comparable to that, food has always been a tool of control, and money. Well, I mean, a lot of people are against money, such as communists and stuff, but money is something that we all certainly use, if not believe in. It's always been a tool of control, and actually literally has been a tool of control since its genesis, regardless of the fact that I support its use within certain limits. And just, you know, and it's just about anything else, like love and marriage has always been a tool of control, and in many cases like state control, but it doesn't inherently delegitimize those things fully, but it might, and to some extent, delegitimize for different people certain aspects of those things. And you got to look at them in the context and say, what of this is a tool of control because it's just obviously going to be incorporated into whatever sort of hierarchical or governing or ultimately course of state structures, and what is actually inherently kind of course of a controlling, or, you know, I don't want to say coercive or controlling in the sense that it kind of an absolute violation of kind of principles of liberty, but strongly contradictory attitudes, I think, to the ones that most of us have. And that's where I've kind of evolved on a lot of my positions. Like I said, I've never ascribed to myself particularly political labels. I've done others, like authors that describe themselves, but I've done that very intentionally. And I think where that really comes from, kind of losing my train of thought.
I think it's really important. And I think Sec was hitting at this. I mean, you know, like I said earlier, how I'm moving away from talking about tech as a liberator to where more spirituality is what can empower the individual. I've found myself really like taking common technological terms and trying to replace them with spiritual concepts. For example, like one of the ways that we're all interconnected right now is through our ISP. Now that's our internet service provider, right? Like Comcast or whatever other, bastardization of existence is out there. And I've replaced the term ISP or the acronym ISP with individual spiritual practice. And I think that's really key for people to grok, is that it is, you know, you are an individual, and, you know, like Sec was saying, you know, what works for you. I mean, it's just like, you know, if somebody is for whatever reason, the predisposition exists, if somebody say is an alcoholic and they want to stop being that, they will often do what? They'll just drink water for the rest of their life, and they'll only drink water. So each of us needs, I think, different levels, different things that come from what I think Sec and Rao were really hitting at earlier, was, you know, when they like to spend a lot of time in nature, and what, you know, in Kabbalah we would call the book of nature. There's two flames. There's Torah and the book of nature, and you can get truth from either. And, you know, just looking at that book of nature and seeing what you need and making that your ISP, your individual spiritual practice. That's step one. And I think that's a big part of what we've been talking about right here.
And I just want to address where I lost my train of thought real quick, just so I don't leave a hanging chad there. And people are like, well, what has this ruse evolved into? I mean, I've just become more one of those guys, and I mean, hate me for it, whatever. I've evolved to the idea that people talk about sort of what is strictly individualist, or what is strictly libertarian, or what is strictly anarchist. And like I said, I've never tried to confine myself within the labels. I'm not a purist where I have a very strict, I have a very narrow definition of sort of the bare minimum for liberty, and beyond, you can go beyond that. But a person that has the idea of, for example, when you see like certain groups that are supposedly anarcho-communists and actually governing federations of anarcho-communist communes in certain parts of the world, or something close to anarcho-communist and similar ideologies, that they're insufficiently anarchist, or they're insufficiently anarchist, or insufficiently decentralized, or insufficiently non-hierarchical, whatever, that I usually say, no, my fault with them is that they are that they're communist. I disagree with the communist philosophy and economic organization, but in fact, I think they're making a pretty good show of the anarchistic governance. So, you know, I'm maybe not so much of a purist on that, and I'm a still very market oriented guy, but you know, I think we are trying to take within the constraints of human reality and human organization, and within the constraints of generation by generation change, and each generation is obviously in the idea that our increments are measured in generations within reality. I think we are trying to incorporate as many principles of, I don't want to say anarchism, but as many anarchistic principles as we can. I think, you know, I'm not trying to be necessarily a purist with things in terms of like utopian ideology. My utopianism is my religion. I don't stick to a strict set of strong like deontological anarcho-capitalist beliefs or strict any other sort of anarchistic or otherwise political beliefs, because my dogma comes from my religion. My dogma doesn't come from any sort of writers or Karl Marx or anybody else. It's you know, I kind of have those bases covered.
All right, well, let's wrap this here. Let's do, thank you guys for coming on, and we'll do this again for real. I'll set it up once we get off here, or after I eat dinner or something. But let's do quick plugs. Let me do, Shane had to run. He's off mushroom hunting. He's out doing magic, because everything's magic. And you can find Shane at passnated.com and on Twitter at LUA Radio and VanuPodcast.com. So that's where you can find Shane. Brian, where can people find you?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm going to point people. You can find me at sovereigntech.com, but I'm going to actually point you directly to fundraiser.sovereigntech.com, where we are trying to put together an amount of money to take everything Sovereign Tech to the next level. And a lot of that does have to do with spirituality. I mean, video, documentaries, all kinds of things that we want to do that we're really excited about. And so head over to fundraiser.sovereigntech.com if you want to donate and to find out more about the show.
Yeah, he's about to do all sorts of weird and fun shit. You should check that out. Awe, where can people find you and such like that?
Yeah, so the podcast can be found at oeui.live. And then you can follow me on Twitter at IHTACast. That's I Hate the Antichrist Cast, IHTA. We're trying to get a partner, a guest partner, or what do you call it? A sidekick. It's just someone I can riff off with. So if anyone's interested and you heard what I had said in the podcast and you think you'd be a good match, just let me know. You can either hit me up on Twitter or use the contact form on the website. I would really appreciate it because I'm trying to do the podcast more regularly and it's been difficult. So yeah. OEUI.live. OEUI.live.
Dope. All right, cool. Well, thanks again, y'all, for coming. We're going to do this again sometime. And everybody listening, be excellent to each other and keep it weird.
Peace.
Ciao.
Thanks.